For the rest of us, let me invite you this morning to turn to Deuteronomy. Probably your favorite book in the whole Bible, right? Deuteronomy chapter 21 today, continuing to work our way through the Jesus backstory. The backstory that is the Torah. If you're grabbing a pew Bible, it's page 140. The words will be on the screen behind me. And today it's Deuteronomy 21. We're going to pick it up at verse 10. So Deuteronomy 21, verse 10, it says, we read Ki Tetzé, what is the name of our Parsha, again, the Torah being divided into 54 Parshiot. And today we come to number 49 of the 54. It begins, Ki Tetzé, translated, when you go, la milhama, to war. So when you go to war, alo yeveha, against your enemies, when you go to war against your enemies. And then from there, this Parsha unveils 74 different commands, 74 mitzvot. In fact, Parsha Ki Tetzé contains more commands than any other Parsha in the whole of the Torah. Notably, it is laws related to family life and relationships, which is fantastic, obligations to one's neighbors, financial economic accountability. In a word, it is all sorts of laws related to, we could say, social responsibility. We can think of caring for the least of these. We can think of compassion for the most vulnerable, which is somewhat, I think, surprising, noting again the opening here, right? When you go to war against your enemies, not to mention that if we jump to the last command, the very last line in this Parsha, it reads there, 25 and 19, you shall blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget. And so we begin with war, we end with annihilation, all of which seems pretty brutal and violent, right? Not at all like caring and compassion, which is why perhaps rabbi and scholar Ami Silver, he writes, this Parsha contains one of the most troubling mitzvot in the entire Torah, Mehiyat Amalek, the command to erase the memory of Amalek, and we can think here the nation, right, the Amalekites, from the, it says, face of the earth. In fact, if we jump back a few verses before, just for a bit of context here, it begins 25 and 17, remember what the Amalekites did to you along the way when you came out of Egypt. When you were weary and worn out, they met you on your journey and attacked all who were lagging behind. They had no fear of God. When the Lord your God gives you rest from all the enemies around you and the land he is giving you to possess as an inheritance, he says you shall blot out. That's from the Hebrew maha. It literally means to annihilate. It means to completely erase. Right, the name of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget. And so in a sense here, not only do we have something violent and harsh and brutal, it's also, we could say, vindictive and vengeful. But maybe not, because, as Jewish scholarship tells us, there is maybe more here than we maybe meets the eye. Noting the greater context here, because there is another command that is very similar to this one in terms of some of the language. What is known as the command or the mitzvah of Yibum. It's found here in verses just before this, found it here in 25 and 5, just a few verses before. It begins, we read, if brothers are living together. Quick note on together here. Together in Hebrew, that can actually mean at the same time, and I think that's probably a better translation. If brothers are living at the same time, so they are both alive, and then we get, and yet one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty, Yibum, in Hebrew, of a brother-in-law to her. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother, so that his name will not be Maha. Right, will not be, it says here, blotted out, will not be annihilated, will not be erased from Israel. So not only do both stories contain the word, the Hebrew word maha, they also contain the Hebrew word shem, which is often translated as name. In this context, it's this idea of legacy. And so on the one hand, we have the mitzvah of Yibum, right? What is what is not blotting out, not erasing the legacy of a brother. On the other hand, we have what is the mitzvah of Mehiyat Amalek, what is the command to blot out, to erase the legacy of Amalek. And so they stand together in contrast, and yet underneath there is woven in this idea of this strand of vulnerability. The mitzvah of Yibum, right? There is a death in the family. And there is a widow. Right now, she is on her own. There's no husband, there's no son, there's no heir. She is the definition of vulnerability, especially in that day. Not to mention her deceased husband, completely vulnerable. His entire legacy is now dependent completely on the decisions that others make, completely on the decisions of the others. And then also notice the mitzvah of Mehiyat Amalek. Notice the language in the telling of the story related to the Israelites. Again, it says, we read, remember what the Amalekites did to you. Verse 18, it says, when you were weary and worn out, while you were, in a word, vulnerable, they met you on your journey and attacked all who were, it says, lagging behind. Right, again, we could say the most vulnerable of the vulnerable. And so these mitzvot, right, Mehiyat Amalek and Yibum, right, there is erasing the legacy, and there is not erasing the legacy. There is attacking the vulnerable, and there is protecting, we could say, the vulnerable. And yet there's also one other connection, maybe deeper, that really brings them together. And to get at that, I want us to jump back to the book of Exodus for a moment. Exodus in chapter 17. Keeping in mind, what we have here in Deuteronomy is a retelling of the story of Amalek. The original story is told actually back in Exodus. And here in Exodus, we get some more detail. We get some more information. And so picking it up here, Exodus 17 and verse 9, it says, we read, the Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites, it says, at Rephidim. And so here the Israelites have just left Egypt. They've traveled through the splitting of the Red Sea. They are now out in the wilderness. They most recently have been without water. They've had no food. The entire nation, we read, they are weary and worn out. And here come the Amalekites in what is really a kind of ambush. Verse 9, Moses, he said to Joshua, choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands. And then verse 10, so Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered. And then we read, and Moses, but not just Moses, right? It also says, notice, Aaron and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. Whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. Verse 12, when Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side, one on the other, so that his hands remained steady till sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekites with the sword. Now, a couple things to note here. First off, note, right, Moses here, he's up, it says, up on the hill, and it says his hands have grown tired. Kaved in the Hebrew. And it carries this really, this idea of heaviness, of vulnerability, of oppression, of it's heavy and it's weight, like he's holding on and he's being oppressed and everything is heavy and it's weighted. And so he's lowering his hands. He's wanting to rest his hands. And notice that is where Aaron and Hur come into the picture. Moses is vulnerable. And so it says they give him a stone to sit on, and then they stand on either side, supporting Moses, right? Holding his hands up. And what we want to get here is that Aaron is the brother of Moses. Hur is actually the son of Miriam, who is the sister to Moses. And so we get this connection, just like we did with Yibum, right, the brother. Here we get a picture again of a brother. And we can think back then to Deuteronomy, Mehiat Amalek. And in the words of Rabbi Ami Silver, he says this, he says, it is the exact same ethic that stands behind the mitzvah of Yibum. When your brother is at his most vulnerable, you come to his aid and take responsibility for him. When your sister is at her most vulnerable, you come to her aid and take responsibility for her. That is when you Mehiat Amalek. That is when you erase the memory of Amalek from the world. Not the people of Amalek, but Zeher Amalek. Right? Erase their legacy. Erase what they stand for. Erase the cruel mentality that seeks to trample on the vulnerable, that views weakness as something to attack. By presenting the story of Amalek together with the mitzvah of Yibum, the Torah shows a radically different paradigm of how to relate to vulnerability. When we see someone who is weak, who is in need, it's our job to support them, to lift them up, to help them accomplish what they cannot do on their own. This is the lasting meaning of the mitzvah to erase Amalek's memory. And so really what at first blush absolutely seems brutal and violent, right, seems vindictive and vengeful, is really about a radically different paradigm. Is really what it means to care for the least of these, is really about what it means to have compassion for the most vulnerable. Now, I'm not a betting man, but I would say probably most of us haven't really ever heard of the mitzvah of Yibum or of Mehiat Amalek, but we know Jesus has, right? Because that's the spirit that flows in and all through the very life and teachings of Jesus, right? From the healing of a man with leprosy to the restoration of a woman from disease, from his feeding of the multitudes to his washing the feet of his disciples, right? To the taking of a child in his arms, to his taking upon himself your sin and mine, right? This is a radically different paradigm. It's a caring for the least of these. It's a compassion for the most vulnerable, which invites us, I think, to consider for ourselves, to use the words of Rabbi Silver, do we live this radically different paradigm? Right? Is this paradigm at the center of who we are, of our day-to-day activities? When we get up in the morning, when we go to bed at night, when we head out the door, is this kind of our central paradigm? This radically different paradigm? Do I go out with that heart of caring for the least of these, that compassion for the most vulnerable? The story is told about Fiorello LaGuardia. Fiorello LaGuardia, he served both in Congress and as mayor of New York City back in the 1930s. And or 1920s and 1930s. I want to say 20s and 30s, and then I think, well, we're into the 20s, right? So a whole different ballgame now. So the 1920s and 1930s, most notably during the time of the Great Depression. And as the story is told, on one intensely cold night, the mayor, during Nightcart, went to what was one of, if not the poorest district in all of the city. And as the story is told, LaGuardia then dismissed the presiding judge and went and sat himself on the bench instead. And after hearing a couple of cases, it's then told that a rather disheveled, tattered, unkempt woman came in. She had been arrested and charged for stealing a loaf of bread. The woman explained to LaGuardia that her daughter's husband had abandoned her, including their two children, her two grandchildren. Since then, they had become rather destitute, and her daughter had become and taken very ill. And as the story is told, LaGuardia became visibly bothered. He became somewhat agitated even. He was distraught. He then addressed the woman saying this. He said, "My dear, I have to punish you. The law makes no exceptions. The judgment is $10 or 10 days in jail." But as he spoke, as he gave this sentence, the observers in the room noticed that he reached into his pocket and took out a bill, a $10 bill, and placed it into what was his famous sombrero. And he added at that moment, "And here is the $10 fine, which I now remit on your behalf." And as the story is told, and this is maybe the best part, as the story is told, he went on to institute then a fine of 50 cents on every other person in the room for the crime of living in a community where a poor woman has to steal bread to feed her grandchildren. And so do we live this radically different paradigm? We could say, am I slanted toward caring for the one in need? Is my life slanted toward caring for the one in need? Is my life oriented, right, toward compassion for the most vulnerable? The reality of this partial reveals, right, going to war, annihilating, erasing, all of it sounds brutal and harsh, and yet the deeper meaning is really about turning our bitterness into blessing, turning our resentment into regard for, right, the one in need. We can think of Moses, right, in need. We can think of the Israelites weary and worn out. And so again, do we live this radically different paradigm? Is your life, is my life, is it slanted toward caring for the least of these? Is it oriented toward compassion for the most vulnerable? And then with that, maybe to consider as we go into the week, who is God calling me to come alongside? Who is God calling me to come alongside? Who is God calling me to offer support? Who is God calling me to lift up? And maybe as we enter into some time of reflection and open worship now, I didn't phrase this in the form of a question, but maybe to also think about who in your life has come alongside? Who in your life has offered you support? Who has come and helped to lift you up? And maybe even this morning, if you feel led, maybe that story of inspiration would be a blessing to others as well. Someone in your life, someone that came along and supported, offered support, lifted you up. And then again, as we go into the week, right, Holy Spirit, come. Lord, come. Teach me, tell me, show me who you are calling me to come alongside, who you are inviting me to offer support to, who might I lift up. When you go to war against your enemies.